Hi, everyone. Dan Cassidy here. Welcome back to Top of the Morning on the UBS Market Moves podcast channel. For today, we will spend some time outlining the macro and market expectations of the UBS Chief Investment Office for the second half of 2024, along with review current positioning recommendations for your portfolio. Joining me here today for the conversation, glad to welcome back Jason Dreho, Head of Asset Allocation for the Americas. We also have joining us today Leslie Falconio, Head of Taxable Fixed Income Strategy for the Americas, as well as Nadia Lovell, Senior U.S. Equity Strategist. So with that, Jason, Leslie, Nadia, thank you all for dropping by Top of the Morning and for spending some time today with our listeners and our clients to share the Chief Investment Office's second half outlook. So Jason, before we talk about what the second half of 2024 might have in store, perhaps we could begin by reflecting on how we got to where we are today. So let's begin by reflecting on the first half of the year. From your vantage point, Jason, how did market macro conditions evolve over the past 6 months relative to what CIO's expectations were at the start of 2024?
Well, Dan, I'd say that the overall path has gone roughly according to plan. You know, we had a view of kind of a soft landing trajectory this year where growth would moderate, inflation would come down, and the Fed would be able to cut rates. So I think directionally true, but I think the magnitude of each of those things have not quite played out the way we, and I think the markets in particular, would have expected. If we just take growth as a starting point, we came off of a very strong second half of the year last year. The thought would be that the growth would moderate a little bit, as this year moved on. And it has, but it's still been sort of above kind of maybe expectations where I think investors had at the start of the year. So I think the growth has been a little bit maybe stronger than people expected. Inflation front, I think where we are today is kind of in line with perhaps what we would have expected, with inflation kind of clearly is kind of slowing down. But the first quarter and the first few months of the year were surprising to the upside. So kind of a rocky start to the year. But kind of where we are now, I think I would say, is not that different to where we thought we'd been in terms of a disinflation trend, except the trend has not been straight. It's been kind of up and down. Maybe the biggest surprise, is on the Fed. Back in January, there's an expectation at some point where the Fed could cut almost as many as seven times this year, including a first cut in March. And now, after the most recent FOMC meeting in June, the market's debating whether it's going to be, the first cut will be in September or December. So it's certainly been pushed out in terms of rate cuts. We were never in the seven or six or seven camp, but we'd have been like in the 3 to 4. So even relative to those expectations, things have been a little bit less than we anticipated. But I think the overall arc of where we thought the economy would play out, the macro would play out this year, I think it's directionally kind of consistent with that, even if the exact path hasn't played out in a simple, smooth line.
Okay, so with that in mind, now that we've reached the midpoint of 2024, Jason, as we look out through the balance of the year, how does CIO anticipate market macro conditions playing out from here?
Well, I'd say that the macro list that I kind of alluded to, that's still kind of the core thesis that we have for the U.S. economy for the rest of this year. That growth will moderate from what was sort of an above trend level last year to around kind of trend this year. And the data that we've gotten on, at least on growth metrics for the past couple of months, would be indications are that's actually playing out. This will also lead to inflation continue to decline. Again, on it, maybe not a smooth path, but certainly ending the year lower than where it is right now. And these combination of factors will give the Fed justification for cutting. We still think in September is the first cut. So two cuts this year versus, the Fed stop plot right now is indicating, only one cut. They were kind of roughly in line with what the overall market pricing is. So I'd still say a relatively, benign, kind of move towards a soft landing, for the rest of this year and into next year, which is still a supportive environment for risk assets. The one thing, just to give context to the markets, thinking about the start of the year versus where we are now, the S&P, being up 13-ish% is, more than we anticipated, more than most investors anticipated. And also, and Lizzie will touch on this, rates, kind of went higher than sort of maybe anticipated at the start of the year and kind of pulled back. So from that starting point, I think on the equity front, I think, maybe upside is a little bit more limited, but I think the direction of travel for risk assets, it still has sort of tailwinds. And we haven't touched at all on kind of the AI story and the tech story that's been a big driver for markets. And Nadia will kind of cover more of that. But I'd say from a macro backdrop in the U.S., but also globally, it's still supportive. Because when we look outside of the U.S., we're seeing kind of an inflection in growth kind of from a low level, starting to kind of get a little bit better in other developed markets in Europe, in Japan. And So that is kind of a positive. And then also central banks are now on the path towards cutting. You know, we've seen the ECB cut, the S&P, the Bank of Canada. You know, the Fed will be later to the game, but directionally now we're going to see, the beginning of, multiple rate cuts, the rest of this year and next year across all major central banks. So a global growth environment that's, relatively stable and directionally kind of getting a little bit better and central banks cutting. Again, that's a pretty good combination for risk assets overall. But the markets are kind of priced for it, so maybe the upside from these levels is a little bit more muted than what we've seen year to date.
So, Jason, another consideration, we came into 2024 as it being a year of elections, not only here in the U.S., but globally as well. How could these elections impact the market outlook from here?
Well, you're right that this would be a year of elections coming into the 2024. We knew that there are 60 elections globally covering more than half the world's populations. And this would be a focus of the markets, potentially a source of volatility. What we've seen thus far in, parts of the world where there's been elections, Mexico, India, two good examples, that, the outcomes have been surprising. It's led to pretty sizable market reactions in both cases. We've also had snap elections, as the case in France, that are going to be coming up at the end of June, early July. That's also had an impact for markets. So it's clearly, with all the other things that are going on in the financial markets in terms of focus on the economy, what the Fed is going to do, the whole AI is kind of new developments. This is another factor that I think will pick up further in the second half of this year, principally because also the focus will increasingly be on the U.S. election in November. And with the first debate coming up unusually early this year, like at the end of June, since 1960, the first debate has not happened until essentially late September. It does have a chance to create some volatility for the markets, kind of move them. We've seen that in the past. We saw that in 2020 when, after the first debate, the markets kind of shifted probability of a Biden win, of a blue wave, and so the markets can react to that. So whether this outcome or at least the perception of the debate could have some implications for the markets. Stepping back, though, I think the bigger question is like, what are the different sort of, for the U.S. election in particular, like, what are the different scenarios from whether what we call say a red sweep, in which President Trump gets reelected, and Republicans take both houses of Congress, comparably sort of a blue sweep or a divided government where you have a President Trump, but then say the House is controlled by the Democrats, or a President Biden and the most likely the Senate in that case would be controlled by Republicans. The red sweep instead of a Biden by Congress are probably the two most likely scenarios with different implications for what it means for the markets in terms of potential implications for fiscal policy, expansionary fiscal policy, constraints in terms of dealing with the budget deficit. That means the interest rate markets could be impacted if it's more expansionary and viewed as more inflationary. Rates, particularly at the long end of the curve, could go higher. These have implications also for the dollar. In addition, if there are tariffs and how much those tariffs go up, all else equal, that tends to be strong for the dollar because other currencies will weaken in order to make their exports to the U.S. More competitive. And then there, at the macro level for equity markets, maybe the impact won't be the same as it's been prior to the last two elections. For the overall market level, with other factors going on, whether it's AI, whether it's Fed cutting rates, just general trends for the economy, what we know from a sector perspective, that there are potential implications on the regulatory front, the energy and financials, in particular, two sectors that we think there's a bigger swing between a President Biden and a President Trump, especially because the president has just much more discretion on regulatory matters, also tariffs and foreign trade, versus fiscal policy tax changes that require legislative action. So definitely some implications. It will be one way or another. There's a lot of uncertainty for next year because only in 2025, the debt ceiling has to be addressed once again. And then by the end of 2025, going back to the 2017 new tax cuts, many of them expire. And so if there isn't some sort of resolution, tax rates could go up significantly. So much of the focus, regardless of the outcome, will be on how much of those tax increases or tax cuts are extended versus expire. So a lot of focus in the second half of this year, really more from an election perspective in terms of what are the policy implications for next year. And it certainly is a source of, at a minimum, source of volatility, even if not big directional moves for the equity markets or the rates markets or even the dollar for that matter overall.
Okay, so if we jump around asset classes a bit to welcome Nadia into the conversation, focusing on equities for a moment. Nadia, we've of course seen a number of record closes throughout the course of 2024 thus far. What are your thoughts on current valuations, and might there be potential for further upside for the S&P as we make our way further through the year?
Yes, Dan, you know, we have a market that's up double digits so far this year, and as you know, it has notched over 30 new record highs. And counting, but much of that really has been driven by earnings growth. It continues to be upgraded to record levels. I mean, more than half of the returns have come from those upward earnings revisions. The rest has come from valuation multiple expansion. So when we look at the forward price to earnings multiple, that's expanded from 20 times at the start of the year to around 21 times today. So just about one turn of multiple expansion. Yes, you know, valuations are elevated versus the longer-term average, but in the context of what appears to be an earnings upgrade cycle, there really isn't that much to write home about. Now, remember, the earnings recession for the broader S&P 500 ended in the third quarter of last year, but much of that was due to the Magnificent Seven recovery. But for the S&P 493, that ended in the first quarter of this year. So much of the multiple expansion that we're seeing is being driven by the technology sector that's now traded at over 30 times forward PE versus 27 times at the start of the year. You know, while this is something that we continue to monitor for any signs of frothiness, of course, at the same time, tech is seeing the strongest earnings revision momentum. So to some extent, one could argue that some of these stocks could grow into their valuation multiple. Now, with that, where does the broader market go from here? Well, you know, we remain constructive and we think that there's further upside to the market. In our base case, the upside is more modest from where we are today, just given the strong recent AI and tech concentrated rally. But that said, what could supercharge this market is if inflation cools faster than expected while economic growth remains intact. So that immaculate disinflation that really pulls forward and accelerates the Fed's cutting cycle. This could help performance broaden out, bring some relief to the interest rate sensitive areas of the market, and drive a cyclical rally. Now again, yeah, this isn't our base case, but it's certainly a possibility. And we do think that the risk is skewed to the upside versus, say, in a more sustained major pullback in the market, just given how solid the economic and earnings growth environment is.
Okay, so that covers equities. Thank you for that insight, Nadia. Turning to the fixed income side to welcome Leslie into the conversation. Leslie, what are your expectations for fixed income markets? Where do you see rates headed through year end?
Yeah, sure. I mean, you know, one of the things that Jason had mentioned is that when we look at the first quarter for SAF, I mean, our expectation was that interest rates would rise given the fact that the market was pricing in so many cuts at the end of December, and we reached like a 3.73 because after the December FOMC, you know, the markets got a little bit overzealous, and once again, they entered 2024 with the expectation that growth would be very slow. And we'd set about a 4.5% level, but we went above that. I mean, the high in the 10-year this year is about a 4.73, 4.74. And when we look at the second half of the year, you know, given what the Fed has guided towards with this, you know, one cut, although we still believe in two cuts starting in September, they've also painted this really soft landing kind of picture. I mean, the no landing is pretty much gone by the wayside now. That's a very low percentage after we've had this recent FOMC meeting. But, you know, the Fed has also painted a picture that is, in my opinion, very rosy. I mean, they have, you know, GDP growth at or above 2% through 2026. They have the unemployment rate between 4 and 4.2 over the next 3 years. And they believe that inflation is going to fall to 2% by 2026. Now, that's the Fed's projection. Now, what the market's going to look at, you know, is that if, in fact, you know, after being 28 months of 4% or below in the unemployment rate, if you do go to that 4.1 or 4.2, the market's not going to react as sanguine as the Fed projection has. If you're going to have a market reaction and the curve is going to, and 10-year yields are going to rally, you know, it's our expectation that, you know, we do expect yields to come down the second half of the year because we do believe that growth will slow towards the Fed projection of slower but above trend, a little weaker but not weak. But we do believe that the market's going to react to that with Treasury yields coming down, because even if we get to, say, that one cut in December, again, our expectation is for two, what they did was that they took that cut, they took it away from 2024 and they put it into 2025. Because the fixed income market is forward-looking, it's going to take all those cuts they have in 25 and bring them forward. And when you really compound that with a, you know, still a slowing but above-trend growth, but an unemployment or a consumer that might be sort of stepping back a bit, and an unemployment that might be rising, you know, and a labor market that might not be as tight as we see in the JOLTS data, I think the fixed income market is going to react a little bit more heavily to that. So our expectation is that 10-year yield will probably be around at 385 at the end of the year. Now, what sort of would counter that would be if, in fact, we have growth, you know, around that 3%. I mean, we have a differentiation right now between what the Atlanta GDP now is showing in terms of growth around that 3% and what the Fed projection is for this quarter, which is like a 2.2. But if growth really starts to reaccelerate, but more importantly, if inflation starts to reaccelerate, then that'll be really something that the market, the fixed income market, will not take long. Interest rates will rise on that. And that could come from any kind of geopolitical risk. It could come from, you know, housing reaccelerating, or simply that the 2 months of lower than expected prints that we've seen on inflation just simply reverses, right? And we see a trend higher. Now, that would be, you know, something that we have to watch out for and a risk to our yields going down in the second half. But right now, we're really comfortable with what we're seeing. And when you think about what happened even last week, you know, we've gotten down to 418. That's not that far from our 385. And if you have this kind of uncertainty, whether it's what's happening in Europe, and you have one unemployment print of, say, 4.1 or 4.2, the market's going to react to that, at least initially. So we stick with the yields going down the second half of the year. We do believe the Fed cuts twice starting in September. And we think that a lot of what they have for the four cuts in 2025 gets pushed forward.
So as we begin to close out, maybe we can spend a few moments on positioning, talk about considerations across a variety of asset classes, beginning with equities. Nadia, how are you recommending that equity investors be positioned at this time?
Yes, Dan. You know, one of the things that we think investors should really emphasize in portfolios, regardless of sector our market cap position is quality. You know, we have a quality bias really focused on companies with real earnings growth, cash flow, and solid balance sheets. Now, anchoring on that, Dan, from a sector standpoint, we continue to have a preference for tech and industrial, as well as themes like artificial intelligence, infrastructure, energy transition, and healthcare innovation like weight loss treatment. AI in particular, we think that it can be an over $1 trillion revenue opportunity by 2027 across the value chain, and one that investors should have exposure to in our view. And when we think about the value chain, we think about it in three layers. One, the enabling layer, so that semis, cloud, data center, power supply companies. And then the intelligence layer, think large language models. And then lastly, that application layer. So companies offering AI services for specific use cases that hopefully someday will make our tasks and lives a lot easier in the future. Now, today, much of the investment is happening in that enabling layer. So building out the AI infrastructure, we particularly favor semis here. Eventually, we do think the opportunity will broaden out to other layers in the months and the years ahead, like software, among others. But we firmly believe that investors should really seize the AI opportunity. And while this is largely concentrated in the U.S., particularly among large cap companies, we do believe that the large will get larger, but it's also a global story. So we would advise exposure to some of those non-U.S. names as well, particularly some of the large AI names in Asia. So, Dan, markets are at all-time high, but there are opportunities about for investors who might still have some apprehension, though, there are also capital preservation strategies that can help mitigate some of that risk, like structured investment strategies that can offer some downside protection while still allowing for some upside exposure.
Leslie, what about your thoughts, guidance when it comes to positioning on the fixed income side?
You know, listen, when we think about really what's happened this year, you know, you've had a tremendous amount of spread compression across assets, whether it's high quality or low quality assets. You've had just spreads continuously compress. I mean, part of that is that we've had such a large amount of cash on the sidelines. Part of it is that, you know, now with like pension funds coming from unfunded to funded, insurance companies looking at that yield, you've had a lot of demand, you know, really across the board. But when it comes to really relative value, although I cannot, there's only a couple of assets that I could really say are still cheap on a relative value side. And people have heard me say this before because I've said it for a long time, but I still feel that way. Agency MBS has been, it still remains one of the cheapest sectors. It's standard deviation cheap in terms of spreads versus their historical averages. The, you know, the lagging that they've experienced really has been due to the constant volatility that we've seen from the market reassessing and repricing that Fed outlook. We believe now, you know, at least although the Fed remains data dependent, you might have these moves like we did with non-farm payroll coming out strong and then CPI coming out weak. You know, you move from, you know, a 448 to a 418 within a week's time. You know, you might still have a little bit of this daily kind of volatility, but over the longer term, particularly in the next 6 months, converge more to the Fed this amount of variance. You know, we think that that volatility should start to come down and the agency MBS will continue to do well. Now, some of the sectors that we really got were invested in, you know, IG corporates, you know, they continue to tighten and spread. I mean, they're, you know, around 90 basis points. We maintain the barbell within that sector simply because the yield curve is inverted, okay, and the yield within IG is upper sloping, unlike the treasury curve, which is inverted, right? So yield in IG, if you go to like a 7 to 10 year, you can actually pick up yield versus if you went from a 2s to 10s in the treasury market, you're giving up yield by going into the 10-year. Here you have the ability to pick up that yield. And we also know that the 1 to 3 year, because of the treasury, is also, you know, yielding very well. Also, we have those two sort of barbells. And why we have this barbell is, one, it's because we want to take the carry, and two, we do want to lock in some interest rate risk around these levels. You know, some of the things in terms of the actual relative value, and we know that high yield has done very well. Sectors that have a high correlation to the equity market has done well, but there's very little room for error. There's just not a lot of risk priced into these risk assets. And it's not as though we're thinking there's going to be some sort of, you know, catalyst or there's going to be an event, but you're simply just not compensated for it. And if you can get better carry going into higher quality, then that's the sector we're going to lean into. I mean, one of the sectors that we had that really underperformed in 2023 was CMBS. And the CMBS sector this first 6 months had done exceptionally well. I mean, BBB CMBS are up 12.5% for the first 6 months. AAA are up, you know, 2.5-3%. And this is when interest rates are rising. So that sector, although it doesn't have the cushion that it once had when we entered, going at the latter part of 2023, we still think there's value there. But otherwise, I mean, you're going into a sector that you're really locking in for not just chasing yield, but having a continuous income stream, right? Not just chasing the yield of money market funds are high, right? I have a good yield right now, but we don't know what there's going to be like in 6 months. But locking in a continuous income stream is really the key. So that's one of the reasons why fixed income has been so attractive, particularly when you look at things like, you know, the equity risk premium, which is, you know, zero to negative. So that keeps fixed income on our radar, and that's why we think fixed income will do well, particularly as we go into 2025, when the Fed really does start to cut and growth does start to slow. But even to the last 6 months of the year, we think that carry will really be a big tailwind to total return.
And then, Jason, what about considerations to keep in mind when it comes to positioning in alternative type investments?
Well, we continue to recommend a diversified allocation to alternative asset classes, whether that is in the private markets, you know, private equity, private real estate, private credit, and of course, hedge funds. You know, part of the consideration, just thinking about the allocation to these asset classes, is the benefits and diversification they can provide to your portfolio. You know, as we've seen really over the past couple of years, the correlation between stocks and bonds and portfolios has been elevated. Certainly that was the case in 22, and even this year you continue to see periods of time when stock and bond returns move together. In an environment where inflation is elevated, that is, you know, often the case. So alternative asset classes can help provide, you know, certainly sources of diversification to your portfolio, you know, given sort of the additional benefits in this environment, especially particularly in an environment where we think volatility is going to pick up and remain so elevated, you know, during the rest of this year, in part because of, you know, the election, not only in the U.S., but elections elsewhere, as we've seen, you know, thus far, you know, even most recently, you know, outside of the U.S. So one is just kind of the diversification benefit. Another is there are attractive opportunities in different pockets of the market, whether it is in areas of certain hedge fund strategies in private credit, but also kind of private equity in an environment where we think there's, you know, there will be kind of opportunities with valuations of certain assets and sectors that are certainly well below the public market. They kind of present opportunities. So the nature of alternative asset classes is it's not a sort of a tactical call. You know, these things should be held kind of over multiple quarters or years. And ultimately, we think it more as a kind of a long-term allocation to portfolio where there's ways to benefit, particularly in this macro environment.
Jason, Leslie, Nadia, thank you all for dropping by Top of the Morning today to spend some time with our listeners, our clients for this first half touch base on the markets, the macro environment, sharing with them your expectations for what the balance of the year might have in store, covering the guidance when it comes to positioning across a range of asset classes. So thank you all again for your time today. Thank you for tuning in. Be sure to visit ubs.com/studios to view the entire UBS Studios suite of podcast channels, along with our video offerings, such as UBS Trending. You can also follow us on Instagram for content highlights at UBS Trending. UBS Studios is part of the UBS Chief Investment Office within UBS Global Wealth Management. Visit ubs.com/CIO to view the latest research.
Investing in an alternative investment fund is speculative and involves significant risks. For a discussion on these risks, please visit ubs.com/CIO-disclaimer-NTA.
UBS Chief Investment Office's investment views are prepared and published by the Global Wealth Management business of UBS AG or its affiliate, UBS. This material has no regard to the specific investment objectives, financial situation, or particular needs of any specific recipient and is published for informational purposes only. As a firm providing wealth management services to clients globally, UBS AG and its subsidiaries offer both investment advisory services and brokerage services. Investment advisory services and brokerage services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. In the USA, UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS AG and a member of FINRA SIPC. For information, please visit our website at ubs.com/workingwithus. For a full legal disclaimer applicable to the independent investment views produced by UBS, please visit our website at ubs.com/CIO-disclaimer.